may proceed.
May it please the Court, Tom McKee on behalf of Appellant Bertram Manassas Associates, LLC. Arguing on our behalf today will be Greg Osfeld, who's been admitted pro acifice.
All right, Mr. Osfeld, welcome to Virginia. We're glad to have you.
Thank you very much. It's an honor, a pleasure, and a privilege to be here. My name is Greg Osfeld. I represent the plaintiff appellant, Birchwood Manassas Associates, LLC. With the court's indulgence, I aspire to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal time.
All right.
The question before this court is whether equitable tolling applies to a plaintiff deprived of the ability to assert a timely claim due to manager misconduct, specifically an irreconcilable conflict of interest and multiple breaches of the fiduciary duties of undivided loyalty and care. Our position is that the Commonwealth of Virginia follows the traditional, centuries-old doctrine of equitable tolling, not something different and narrower, as the defendants contend. The traditional doctrine of equitable tolling is not limited to instances of fraud.
But doesn't the traditional doctrine still require evidence of reasonable reliance on whatever the bad conduct is that makes up the estopping feature?
Respectfully, Your Honor, it would be our position that what the traditional doctrine requires are extraordinary circumstances that prevent the assertion of a claim in due season. If the doctrine of equitable estoppel is predicated on a claim of fraud, then reasonable reliance is most certainly required. Here, however, Your Honor, we're predicating it on a claim of manager misconduct.
Well, how did the misconduct and the alleged breach of fiduciary duties prevent the claim from being asserted earlier? You could do a dissolution action. You can do, in this case, well, it was done, a dissolution action or even a derivative action.
Your Honor, the dissolution action was brought by a minority member of the entity. The plaintiff itself, the entity Birchwood Manassas LLC, is a manager-managed LLC. It can only act through its managers. There is no indication that, in point of fact, Your Honor, I think the Kansas Supreme Court provides guidance as to why this action could not be brought. As it noted, where you have a situation of an irreconcilably conflicted defendant, in that case the manager of both a bank and the executor of an estate which did business with the bank, it was inconceivable to think that the irreconcilably conflicted defendant could be expected to maintain suit against himself.
Maybe I misspoke, but why couldn't a derivative action have been filed by the non-managers and thereby have them an opportunity to take over the claim, take over the case?
Well, Your Honor, as you know, the circuit court speculated in a footnote that perhaps a member derivative action could have been brought to assert this claim. And the defendants, though they did not brief that issue below, have now made that a centerpiece of their appeal. But we contend that that was an erroneous speculation by the circuit court. Because a manager-managed LLC acts through its managers, not its members, even if one were to accept the speculative inference that a non-managing member might have pursued such a claim if he had had the motive, the knowledge, and the resources to do so, even that would not be the same as the LLC itself pursuing the claim.
The problem is that under the law, a derivative action is at least theoretically possible. And it would appear to be your burden to show why it could not have been done in this instance in order to trigger equitable tolling.
Your Honor, I would respectfully disagree with that. Even though a derivative action is theoretically brought on behalf of the entity, it is not brought by the entity. It is brought by a nominal plaintiff purporting to act on behalf of the entity. And whether derivative standing can be asserted and whether a derivative claim can be brought is a heavily fact-dependent question.
But I'm not sure that's right. In a derivative suit, the trial judge allows the minority shareholder to have the rights of the corporation and to sue as the holder of the cause of action.
If the minority member or minority shareholder can meet the derivative standing requirement.
That's Justice Mims' question. Shouldn't you present evidence? We could not have done this. It wouldn't work because it wouldn't meet these standards of the derivative suit. Two, we didn't know enough information to even start this thing, or three, or whatever. But it seems like you've looked to the defense to disprove that hypothesis as opposed to prove its inability here.
No, Your Honor. It's our position that the existence or non-existence of a derivative suit is a question for a non-managing member. We represent the entity. The entity itself was clearly disabled from bringing a claim. The question of whether a non-managing member had knowledge, had sufficient motive, had the resources to bring a claim is a potential defense that might be brought, but it is not equivalent to the ad, to the member itself acting, and it is certainly not something that would be appropriate at the plea and bar stage.
But counsel, the equitable tolling, tell me if I'm wrong here. You are making the argument that it would have been significantly more difficult for a minority member to bring a derivative action than it would have been for the managers to bring an action.
That is certainly the case. It would certainly be more difficult.
Let's say that we all agree that it would have been a harder row to hoe. But the words that you've used already are, we were prevented.
Yes.
We were deprived. Those two verbs aren't equivalent to, it was a heck of a lot more difficult. It seems that, I mean, am I wrong that equitable tolling applies when you are prevented or you are deprived by the affirmative action of a third party?
Correct, Your Honor.
You have not yet explained why you are prevented or deprived when there is the opportunity for a derivative action. And I think that's the burden that you had to clear at trial.
Agreed, Your Honor, but I'm concerned about some confusion with the use of the pronoun you and who the entity is that I represent. It is my obligation to show that the plaintiff, Birchwood Manassas LLC, a manager-managed LLC, was prevented from timely filing an action.
And a derivative action, how would a derivative action have been styled? If John Doe is the minority interest holder, how would he have styled his derivative action if he was aware of the facts that have led you into court?
It would have been styled by John Doe as a nominal plaintiff on behalf of the entity.
Okay.
And Your Honor, I make no bones about that. I agree that when a non-managing member acts derivatively, he purports to act on behalf of the entity. But nonetheless, this court in Missions Residential versus Triple Net Properties still recognizes the clear line of distinction between an LLC and its members. They are entirely separate and distinct.
Yeah, but when a minority member does that and wins the derivative suit, the money doesn't go to the minority member. The money goes to the corporation.
Correct.
All right. Well, why isn't that the end of this argument?
Because the minority member is still acting initially as the minority member, and only after acquiring standing from the court and meeting the elements of pleading a derivative suit is the minority member enabled to act as a nominal plaintiff on behalf of the
LLC. All right. That's the price you pay to have to get around the statute of limitations. Why is that so egregious?
Your Honor, respectfully, I think it places too high a burden on a manager-managed LLC to require it to plead and prove that none of its minority non-managing members could have met the burden to assert derivative standing. It conflates the distinction between a non-managing member and the LLC itself. Is it hypothetically possible that a non-managing member could have brought a derivative suit in this case? Perhaps, but those facts have not been developed. The circuit court short-circuited litigation on the merits. It never even allowed us to get to the question, and it put us, a liquidating trustee who is not a non-managing member, in the position of trying to identify why different individuals, non-managing minority members, did or did not attempt to act derivatively.
How did your case eventually get into court?
There was a non-managing member who brought a liquidation.
Why couldn't they have done that sooner? Before the statute of limitations ran?
Your Honor, I don't have the facts to know why the non-managing member could not have done it sooner. I just know that it was not sooner.
Let me ask it another way. If they did it at the time that they did, how did you argue that they were somehow prevented, deprived, stopped from doing it sooner so that they could have met the statute of limitations?
Your Honor, respectfully, I think it places too high a burden on me to have to argue why, to have to identify why a non-managing member acted when he or she did to bring about the dissolution of an entity. I represent the entity, not the non-managing members. I don't have the knowledge of what knowledge came to the non-managing members when, what motives caused them to act when they acted, and what resources they had that enabled them to act when they did.
But aren't those facts that the court would need to know in order to determine whether to apply equitable tolling? So I'm not asking you what your role is as advocate. I'm asking you to step into the role of the judge.
Of course.
Would not the judge have needed to have the answer, have needed to have those facts in order to say, Okay, equitable tolling is going to apply now.
Respectfully, Your Honor, not at the plea and bar stage. Perhaps later in the case when there can be factual development of these issues, but at the plea and bar stage, I would contend what my obligation is as the manager-managed LLC is to argue that there were extraordinary circumstances of manager misconduct that made it inconceivable that my entity, my plaintiff, could have acted under the circumstances available to it within the statute of limitations.
What would happen with this hypothetical? You have a manager who sits on a claim, a corporate claim, for 3 years. And let's say for the sake of argument, there's some nefarious thing that's motivating that. There's no dissolution, no stockholder derivative suit, no liquidating trustee or any of that stuff. And then a new manager comes on board, year four, and the new manager looks at the books and says, for heaven's sakes, we got all these things out there that the statute has expired on. And the corporation sues the defendants on those causes of action that are now subject to an expired statute of limitation. Under your argument, as I understand it, the corporation with the new manager would be able to say, well, I'm the new sheriff in town, and the old sheriff screwed this up. And I didn't know he was doing this. None of us really knew.
I would essentially agree with Your Honor's analysis on that.
That's pretty extreme, though, isn't it? Is there case law that supports the use of equitable estoppel in a situation like that?
Well, Your Honor, I think the key issue here is where you're talking about a manager, essentially what you're describing is a manager breaching his fiduciary duty of undivided loyalty and care to the corporation by failing to act within the statute of limitations. That is a relatively rare and extraordinary circumstance, and I would contend that it is an extraordinary circumstance that meets the elements placed by this court in the Brunswick case, and also suggested by the Kansas Supreme Court in the Payton case and the Tenth Circuit in the Yeager case. Those are all, and also by the Bankruptcy Court of the Northern District of Oklahoma in the Sheffield Steel case, where you have a manager acting with divided loyalty who breaches his fiduciary trust to the corporation, or in this case to the LLC, and prevents the LLC from acting to support its claims. Those are extraordinary circumstances in which equity will act to preserve the claim.
Counsel, I want to go back to the line of questions that you and I were on. Were you prevented from putting on evidence at the plea and bar?
Your Honor, we were. My understanding is when the plaintiffs, when the defendants made the decision to proceed with their plea and bar solely on the pleadings, the circuit court at that point indicated that it would not hear evidence, and we were, in fact, prevented from putting forward evidence on the original plea and bar. By the time we got to the plea and bar on the amended complaint, everyone knew it was going to be on the pleadings alone, so there was no request made by either side to put forward evidence. I see that I'm into my aspirational rebuttal time. If there are no further questions I can answer at this point, I'll reserve the remainder of my time.
Well, you actually have achieved your aspirations, which is more than some.
Thank you, Your Honor.
You have 2 minutes and 20 seconds.
Good morning. May it please the Court. My name is Andrew Bircher, and I represent the appellees Birchwood at Oak Knoll and Birchwood at Wading River. I'll use Oak Knoll and Wading River for short. Your Honor, this case is certainly not an extraordinary circumstance, and the facts related to them certainly are not extraordinary such that this court should, for the first time in its history, equitably toll the statute of limitations.
Well, siphoning off $7-plus million dollars from one LLC to two others for apparently no apparent objective business necessity reason, that's pretty extraordinary.
Your Honor, siphoning off, they were loaned as the amended complaint.
Well, generally speaking, you don't loan $7 million without having a loan document, for example.
Your Honor, these are family-owned businesses in which 91% or greater of the memberships between these two entities are exactly the same. And there's no reason that family-owned businesses can't do from accounts, irrespective of the amount of the money that you're talking
but
about.
But was it the corporate purpose of Birchwood Manassas Association, LLC, to be the lender of choice to Birchwood Oak Knoll and Birchwood Wading River? I mean, was that the job of the corporation?
It's certainly plausible, Your Honor, because that was the way that it was done for Birchwood Manassas. Birchwood Manassas got its funding from its predecessors and interests. This was seed capital. Seed capital that was used to start the business, and it's much better to go out and get seed capital from your own family than it is to go and borrow. This is what allowed these entities certainly to survive the economic downturn if they didn't have to have the loan called during that time period. But, Your Honor, with regard to this, a couple things with regard to this appeal. First, we believe as a preliminary matter, the assignments of error did not accurately reflect the trial court's ruling. The trial court never concluded that these actions by these the managers prevented anything from happening. And that's, I think, the key issue here, is was there prevention? And there wasn't. The fact is, as you pointed out, Justice Kelsey, that they did not pursue the action doesn't mean that they could not. And that's the burden that they have with regard to performing equitable tolling or equitable estoppel. This court, in many, many cases, when it's applied the doctrine of equitable estoppel, has said that the party seeking to invoke the doctrine of equitable estoppel must prove by clear, precise, and unequivocal evidence that a material fact was falsely represented or concealed. That's not here. And in fact, in the amended complaint, these documents, the plaintiff actually alleges that there was such ultimate full disclosure in every one of the books and records of the company that this actually amounted to a reaffirmation of the loan. The tax records indicated that. The books and records indicated that. So with regard to this was a fully disclosed loan, and there was nothing that prevented the members of the LLC from pursuing actions that they felt they were wrong.
May I interrupt you there? Equitable estoppel is equity. And the fact that a dozen cases may define equity in a certain circumstance as being fraudulent or something like that doesn't mean it's not a broader concept. It obviously is. And includes many things in addition to fraud.
It does, Your Honor. I understand that.
Well, their initial point is that there can be, in certain circumstances, a breach of fiduciary duty so grave, so egregious, that a chancellor would say, I just cannot stomach not stopping them from asserting these statutes of limitation.
But then in this case, Your Honor, the trial court decided that it wasn't. We believe that was her discretionary decision. The whole idea in this plea and bar and then the application of statute of limitations, everybody acknowledges in this case that the statute of limitation applies and that the 3-year statute of limitations bars this cause of action. It became their burden, as you mentioned, Justice Mims, that it became their burden to bring forward some form of allegation that would say how they were prevented. And merely having a conflict of interest is not sufficient to say that the entities were prevented from pursuing their claims in any, you know, in any fashion.
Now, it sounds like they believe a different standard applies to the non-managing member versus the LLC in terms of how they were prevented.
I still don't understand how they were ever even prevented, Your Honor. These facts were known to everybody. I mean, the fact is, as alleged in the amended complaint, the loans were fully disclosed in the books and records of the company. If you think about this, if the members wanted to prevent loans, that the managers could not have done loans, they could have said in the operating agreement, you're not allowed to do loans. I mean, we do that routinely in operating agreements. We routinely say you're only allowed to borrow or lend X amount of money. That wasn't done. These managers have full authority to issue these loans, and there's nothing in the amended complaint that says that they were not allowed to do that. And I think that's important. These loans were permissible. The issue that they're having is when did they, with regard to the collection of the loans. Your Honor, and I think another important point is the plaintiff here is not proceeding on any statutory exception to the statute of limitations. It is and this court has made it clear in Casey versus Merck that the statute of limitations serve an important purpose and are strictly enforced, may not be told in the absence of clear statutory authority to that effect, and any doubt must be resolved in favor of enforcement. So they don't rely on 8.01.229 in any fashion, which are the statutory exceptions. They're coming in here with their hand in hand saying, you know, these circumstances are so extraordinary that this court, in the first time in its 200-plus year history, should equitably toll the statute of limitations. And Your Honor,
that the statute of limitations by themselves were meant to codify out of existence the concept of equitable tolling?
No, Your Honor, I'm reciting the court's general principles associated with statute of limitations, and that this court has, in very limited circumstances, looked at equitable tolling or equitable estoppel, and has never found extraordinary circumstances such that it actually would toll the statute of limitations outside of the 8.01-229 statutory exceptions that the legislature has enacted. Your Honor, I'd like to turn to our cross-assignment of error. In this case, the appellee has cross-appealed an issue associated with the use of the statute of limitations. While the appellate contends that this case is important from the considered equitable tolling doctrine, the appellees believe that it's a very important case from the standpoint of the use of the list pendants. As we sit here today, even though the case has been dismissed on the plea and bar based on the statute of limitations, the plaintiff still maintains a list pendants on the property of Oak Knoll. The question before the court on this issue is whether or not simply asking for a constructive trust as a remedy for unjust enrichment is a sufficient claim to file list pendants under 8.01-268B. This court has not had the opportunity to look at the list pendants statute since 8.01-268B was added to it, and that section of the statute says specifically that in order to file a memorandum of list pendants, the party has to seek to establish an interest by the filing party in the real property described in the memorandum. In this case, Birchwood Manassas freely admits that it does not seek title to the property.
If the judgment below were affirmed on the merits, would that render moot the list pendants issue, or are you all setting up a cause of action for wrongful filing of list pendants for the future?
Your Honor, it would render moot the issue, because if this court were to affirm the trial court's decision below, the list pendants would be removed. The issue still is that Birchwood at Oak Knoll has been damaged by the list pendants.
Well, how would that be handled? Suppose there are collateral consequences of an erroneously entered list pendants. Would it be handled in this suit, or would it be a separate suit? It would
be a separate suit.
So if it were moot in this suit, and we just sent it down and said we affirm the judgment, and the trial judge says, okay, well, that moots the list pendants, I'll take that off. You're saying there could, in theory, be a separate action later filed that would require us eventually, if it came back up here, to address whether the list pendants was correct in the first instance.
That is possible. And that concludes my argument.
Thank you very much. Mr. Rothschild, you have 2 minutes and 20 seconds.
Thank you. During opposing counsel's argument, I had an opportunity to review the record, and I was able to confirm that we were, in fact, prevented from putting on evidence. The relevant excerpts from the circuit judge's ruling are at pages 375 to 376 of the joint appendix, where the court expressly recognized that we wanted to put on evidence and were prevented from doing so.
Did you proffer
Did you assign errors?
Yeah. What was the rationale for not allowing you to put on evidence?
Because the defendants relied solely on the pleadings for their plea and bar, and therefore the circuit court held that it would rely on the pleadings in determining whether to grant or deny the plea and bar. And we did not assign error to that because we feel on the pleadings alone we should have prevailed on the plea and bar. But this does raise an important point regarding the issue of a minority member derivative suit, because that is not an argument that was even briefed below. It was raised for the first time at oral argument on the second plea and bar, and then the circuit court referenced it in a footnote. I would respectfully submit that if this issue had been raised at any time before the trial court, there would have been an opportunity either to plead or put on evidence to show that the minority members could not or would not have been able to file a derivative suit on behalf of the entity. At a minimum, Your Honor, we should not be precluded at this stage from even proceeding on our suit based on an argument that was not briefed below and was raised for the first time in a footnote in the circuit court's opinion. We should at least have an opportunity to be heard on that issue to the extent that this court concludes that it was our burden to demonstrate that the minority members could not have brought a derivative suit.
Now, I would ask you a question. You represent the entity itself, correct?
The entity itself, not the minority members.
Right. And the entity itself hired the managers?
The entity itself hired the managers.
And they knew that the managers had the conflict. So why are they entitled to equity? The managers that you hired, you knew had a conflict, allows you to equitably stop a separate party?
Respectfully, Your Honor, I think this is a point that is confused in the defendant's briefs. We're not asserting that common management isn't in and of itself a conflict. What we are asserting is that a conflict arose as a consequence of the manner in which these three entities, the plaintiff entity and the two defendant entities, were all being managed. When that conflict arose, it was the manager's obligation to resolve the conflict by, for example, appointing an independent member, an independent agent, somebody to act on behalf one entity or the other.
And so if your manager is an F, or they violated any obligation they have, you sue the manager. Well, why are you entitled to equity? You can do those things at law. Why are you in a situation where you're entitled to equity?
Again, Your Honor, you in this instance would be the minority members.
No,
they're entitled to sue.
But you're not representing the minority interest. You're representing the entity itself. Why is the entity itself entitled to equity?
Because the entity was deprived of its remedy due to its manager's misconduct.
The manager that it hired.
The manager that it hired. And the manager who, when an irreconcilable conflict of interest arose, did not act as necessary to preserve the claims of the entity. It was inconceivable that they would have sued themselves. And as a consequence, those are the circumstances that give rise to equitable tolling. I see that I'm out of time.
All right. Thank you very much for your argument.
Thank you.
Call the next case.